Hello and welcome to our first Gascast of 2012. Coming up on this month's podcast, a potential answer to the timing of TPN debate, the future of airway research, and a crash course on genome-wide association studies. We'll also be doing our discoveries of the month, playing Biology or Bunkum, and introducing our brand new Nerd Factor question. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me for a very international podcast unlike any other, all the way from freezing cold Toronto, is Rebecca Smith.
Hey.
Currently sunning himself in Cape Town, Frank Schneider.
Hello.
And from exotic Epsom in Surrey, Mark Salmon.
Hello.
So, apart from anything else, the next approximately 1 hour is going to be a real stress test for Skype, as the crow flies, a round trip between us would currently traverse 17,500 miles. So, thanks very much to everyone who got in touch via the website to let us know you were listening. It was really great to hear from you, and thank you for the suggestions and feedback. We now have a Twitter account, which is @Gascast, where in addition to the blog, we'll be updating you with our tricky Venflon triumphs, mad whiffery frustrations, and other events of dubious significance. But please use either the website or Twitter to get in touch, and please follow us. We're currently feeling rather lonely, as we only have one solitary friend, and that was someone asking why we were called Gascast, so I expect not a regular listener.
Do you think they were disappointed with the answer?
I think they were very disappointed because I didn't answer them back because they were called the Gas Junkie, and I was a little bit that made me a bit nervous. But what I can say is I didn't answer them back, and this was about a month ago when I registered it, and they've not unfollowed us. So, despite our lack of tweets and lack of answer. Anyway, please follow us because we're feeling rather lonely. So, moving on to Discovery of the Month. I'm absolutely brimming with discoveries this month, and I don't want to upstage you. So, Rebecca, how is the fair land of Canada treating you?
Well, it's cold. It's really, really cold. And there's some strange things here, like the fact that we don't have IV paracetamol. So this was my discovery of the month, and it's probably something I should have known about, and I may well have known it when I was doing my FRCA. But it's about IV paracetamol and when it peaks. So some people have told me that it peaks after 15 minutes, and some people tell me that it peaks after an hour. And although it may not seem important, I think it probably is with regards to regional anesthesia and whether there's any point or not giving IV paracetamol while you're doing a cesarean section. So I did some research, and what I found out is that the plasma peak is at 15 minutes, but the analgesic peak effect is at 1 hour. So I think work age or timing is actually, there's probably no point in giving IV paracetamol when you're doing regional anesthesia, and that you can save it. The nursing staff can give it in recovery. So that was my discovery.
Oh, that's interesting. So one less thing to worry about.
Totally. Not that we have it in Canada anyway, so it's a bit pointless, but I shall use it when I get back to the NHS.
Is that because you have acetaminophen?
We don't need IV. We've got nothing.
Really?
Yeah. Just use a whole lot of opioids.
Do they not have it PR?
They do.
Because that's the thing that's always, I've found a bit surprising at the end of a cesarean section is, in the UK anyway, there's two drugs for which we've got perfectly good IV formulations, which they insist on giving PR. I don't really understand why.
It's cheap.
It's not. PR paracetamol is more expensive than IV.
Well, not diclofenac. Diclofenac is more expensive IV.
I find that hard to believe because it's a very generic off-patent drug, so people should be making it for pence.
Maybe you can research that for us for next podcast, Bex.
Awesome. My next discovery.
I think obstetricians still think it's got some kind of local effect if you jam it in that close.
maybe you could do that instead of this very complicated research study that you told us before we started recording that you were doing. Maybe you could do one on obstetricians' opinions of the mechanism of action of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
I will keep that as my second choice. Yes, thanks.
Awesome. Frank, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule of sun and Mai Tais. But can you tell us, what have you discovered apart from the effortless convenience of room service in the last couple of days?
Well, mine, I do have to throw myself back to the last bit of academic exposure I had. And I was at a conference that was talking about antibiotic resistance and multi-drug resistance. It was obviously quite topical. And I thought I'd share with you from that, that you may or may not know, that we all carry an average of 1.7 kilograms of bacteria on us.
Oh.
So those of you wishing to lose weight might want to go for a good scrubbing. And I think we've done this in a biology or bunkum or something related to that in one of the podcasts. But also what was interesting is that antibiotic resistance genes have actually been found in fossils. So fossils dated a couple of million years old. They found gene sequences that would confer antibiotic resistance.
Well remembered. That was a biology or bunkum.
Yeah, so I thought, when you said that, I remember thinking that was bunkum. But yeah, there's very good evidence. And the last one was that in... I imagine I know why they do it, but they actually do samples of street puddles in New Delhi as a sort of surveillance measure of, what's out there and it going to kill you. And in 30% of puddles, they have found bacteria with meropenem resistance genes. And the worry, obviously, is that, I'm sure you guys remember about how we think that resistance can be transmitted from bacteria and phages and whatever else, but that these gene sequences can therefore spread, and that there is obviously the potential for meropenem resistance to spread into mainstream bugs. Anyway, really interesting stuff, and obviously, again, the topical bit is what we're going to do when resistance becomes more widespread and new sort of ways of treating infections.
Can I just ask, did you go to an entire conference on antibiotic resistance?
No. This was actually the Intensive Care Society State of the Art meeting, and it was just a morning on a couple of interesting talks on antibiotics and antibiotic resistance in the ICU setting mostly.
I want to know where the 1.7 kilograms of bacteria are. I mean, are they on my thighs? Or
I don't think they're neatly piled into one spot that you could shed easily. I think that's distributed across your membranes and cavities.
Awesome.
What a mental image.
Lovely.
I think that's the correct anatomical term.
Well, let's move quickly around our massive transatlantic table. And Mark, what have you discovered this month?
So I've got a smartphone or tablet app. I say that, I'm pretty sure it's only available on Apple.
Just to annoy Rick.
Yeah, it's called ICU Notes, and it's a collection of notes about intensive care, surprisingly enough, put together by some consultants, or a consultant from the Royal London Hospital. And it's a very simple app. It is just a large collection of notes about various subjects to do with diagnosis, management, and critical care in general. And it's really growing on me, this app. At first look, it's fairly basic. It's a lot of text notes, not a lot of pictures. But actually, the more you delve into it, the more I've realized what a vast amount of useful stuff is on here. The kind of things that can keep you awake in the middle of the night. All sorts of things.
Is it free?
It's totally free, yeah.
Cool.
Oh, we do love a free app.
I think what's interesting as well is I had a quick look at it, but it sounds like it was developed from the author's sort of lecture notes or teaching notes that he uses for trainees coming through there. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it is actually. I think there were a series of protocols and various other bits and pieces that the Royal London use that were kind of condensed into, as you said, a sort of set of notes or one of those kind of handbooks, or if you're at George's, kind of like the grey book, I think, is what the format is. Is it like that, Mark?
Yeah, it's very much like that. It's divided into basic critical care, and then a section on diagnosis and causes, a section on management, and a section of algorithms that cover, a wide range of stuff through trauma, medical conditions, sepsis, and just general.
It sounds really good.
All round tool.
Excellent. So I'll be looking forward to that coming out on BlackBerry soon, I'm sure. Is someone running a tap?
What's that?
I'm making tea.
You're making an espresso.
Tea, actually, but I just...
Oh, okay, so that was actually you boiling a kettle. Okay, So before I was into, I quite fancy a cup of tea, actually. Yeah. So I've got two discoveries, both quite amazing. One is, I don't know if anyone's seen the campaign for the hands only CPR. It's basically a campaign by the British Heart Foundation. Yes. Have you seen it? It's brilliant, isn't it?
Is that the one with Vinnie Jones?
Yes.
Oh, it's excellent, yeah.
We'll put the link on the podcast notes, but basically, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's a campaign by the British Heart Foundation to encourage bystander CPR. And I think the rationale, which I'll come to in a bit, is what's putting people off is having to do the mouth-to-mouth. And what they're trying to get you to do is just do hands-on CPR. It's a two-stage process. Dial 999, start doing CPR. But the best bit is they've got Vinnie Jones to do this 1.5 minute video, which is called Hard and Fast, and he's brilliant. The video's so well done. He does this bit, he's like, no kissing, you only kiss your missus on the lips, and then starts sort of explaining how to do CPR. It's really well scripted, actually. Every single sentence he says is kind of an action or something you need to do, and also something that you're going to remember. And then they actually do it to the beat of Staying Alive. He's got these two heavies standing behind him doing this amazing dancing. It's really, really, great.
Do you know
great.
Why they will have chosen him? I saw him, I think he was on Piers Morgan's Life Stories, or somebody, maybe it was Oprah, but something like that. And his wife has got... she had some sort of heart disease, and she had a transplant about 20 years ago. So that will be why they will have chosen him. Yeah. Oh.
I've just tweeted the YouTube link onto our Gascast Twitter feed.
Brilliant. So it's on our Twitter link, but we'll also stick it on the podcast notes, because obviously that's going to be a little bit after then. But yeah, have a look at it. I had a quick look to see what the sort of why there was this push for it. The only thing I could actually find was that there's a study come out of Japan relatively recently looking at the outcomes of 55,000 Japanese adults who had cardiac arrests. And apparently there was no statistical difference between people who received hands only as opposed to conventional CPR. And that's looking at the outcome of favorable neurological outcomes, a month later. And they did compare that with placebo, i.e. people who had nothing done. I haven't actually got the figures on that. This was just on somebody's blog. But I think that's the rationale behind it. And it does make sense. And over the last few cycles of updates from the Resource Council, we've seen more and more emphasis towards compressions rather than airway management. So that was great. And in fact, I also had a look. I can't remember how I came across this, but the AHA, which is the American Heart Association, I think they may not have started this, but they've got their own version, using a comedian and doctor who you might not know the name. I don't know if you know Ken Jeong.
No.
He's South Korean originally. You'd recognize him if you see him. He's on loads of American TV shows and films, but he's a guy who...
Not a guy from The Hangover.
I think he is. Yeah, I think he is from Hangover, actually. No, I think he is that guy. He's doing an equally funny version. Oh, it's not equally funny. It's quite funny. Again, with Staying Alive, and it's during a game of charades. It's fantastic. Have a look for that one as well.
He's a doctor, is he?
He is
the guy from The Hangover.
Yeah, he is a doctor.
Yeah. He is a doctor.
He's got an interesting career history.
And my other discovery is that Sir Paul McCartney goes to the same gym as me.
Really?
No joke. I was in the gym this afternoon. I was like lying on an exercise mat trying to work off my Christmas inflation, and this guy walks into the gym, and I look at him like, that's Sir Paul McCartney. And then I thought to myself, I've never seen him in the flesh at all, and I just thought to myself, no, it can't be, it's got to be somebody who looks like him. And then sure enough, as he came closer, I'm like, I'm sure that's him. And then he comes up to me, and in a Liverpudlian accent, which I won't try and do, says, are you using that weight? And I'm like, no, go ahead, it's all yours.
No. But you better wipe it down when you're finished with it.
True story. I believe they are going to make a film out of that, and Julia Roberts is lined up to play me.
Well, he's either slumming it or you're paying too much for your gym membership.
It's actually a really cheap gym. It is a really cheap gym. I think it's something to do with the location, the fact that it's so not many people.
Well, he's had some expensive divorces, hasn't he? Maybe he can't afford a better one.
Yeah, it was a really surreal experience. So we should probably move on to our news items, and Bex, you're going to be telling us about something from the recent anesthesia supplement on airway management, which I'm afraid I'm not going to have anything to say about because my anesthesia login seems to be broken. Well, my login's not broken, but the link on the site to get through to the Wiley Online bit where you can download the things was broken. So I was very disappointed.
Ah.
Please fix that anesthesia. Well, no.
Yeah, actually, I couldn't get through either, Bex. So I'm sure you'll tell us all about it.
I will. So I read the AGBI anesthesia supplement from December, which is titled State of the Art in Airway Management. And there's a whole group of international authors that discuss a wide range of airway issues and challenges that face anaesthetists all around the world. And I thought it was quite nice that they've dubbed us as the guardians of the airway, which sounded suitably posh to me. There's a couple of common themes running through the supplement. One of them is the NAP4, which features very strongly. And then there's a lot of ongoing statements regarding the need for strong evidence for us to base our decision-making process on. There's several topics which I thought were interesting. One of them was a discussion around rapid sequence intubation with Selleck maneuver. And apparently, I don't know this, but when Selleck initially described his rapid sequence induction, he did actually include positive pressure ventilation. And the current apneic strategy that we use now was introduced by two guys called Stitt and Safer because of concerns of regurgitation. But they based this only on 80 patients, which had full stomachs, and there was no control group. Now, the actual technique of cricoid itself may not be particularly efficient. Apparently, in up to half of patients, the esophagus actually displaced laterally from the cricoid, so it's completely inefficient. And you can make life a lot more complicated if you've got an overzealous assistant that, you know, causes upper airway obstruction with excessive force, or when you've got the cricoid, it can interfere with your LMA placement if you have a failed intubation. So what they're saying is that actually now that we have much better ventilators and we can be much more accurate on how much peak inspiratory pressure we use, is it actually that we should reconsider our technique for rapid sequence intubation and actually make it routine to maintain oxygenation during it? So I thought that was quite interesting, and that might be something that changes for us in the future. Then another article came out of Ann Arbor in the States, and it was about difficult face mask ventilation and the ongoing debate really about whether people should check for face mask ventilation after having induced anesthesia. So I thought I'd just check who does check. You know, if you've given a good dose of propofol, do you check before you give a long-acting muscle relaxant? Mark?
No.
Rick?
No.
Frank?
No, I don't check either.
Interesting.
Or I should say I no longer check.
Yeah, I agree with Frank. I definitely used to, and then I realised...
What's the point?
It was pointless.
Exactly. So this is what they said, is that the arguments for bag mask ventilation are actually pretty slim, because the reason why you're doing it, presumably, is that you have that potential to wake the patient up. But how many anaesthetists would actually not check... how many anaesthetists would actually wake a patient up after having given a dose of propofol? So hardly anybody. So it does seem to be almost pointless. However, the point is also that if they did encounter difficult bag mask ventilation, you could then maybe suck some methonium as opposed to your long-acting muscle relaxant. And that muscle relaxants can, in fact, make face mask ventilation more difficult because you get further collapse of the upper airways. However, I mean, this is vastly outweighed by the arguments against it. So there was a study in anesthesia last year which showed that muscle relaxants improve bag mask ventilation. There was a guy called Ketterfell who showed that in 50,000 patients, only 2 patients that had failed mask ventilation needed to be woken up for an awake fiber optic, and everyone else was managed with other airway adjuncts. We've also got supraglottic airway devices now, so you can generate higher inspiratory pressures. We've got the bronchoscopy, and a study on the GlideScope that they mentioned showed that when it was used to rescue failed direct laryngoscopy, there was only a 6% failure rate. And then, of course, if you use rocuronium, you could always have your potential to reverse it with Sugammadex. Now, they didn't actually say which one they were in favor of, but what they did say was that you should have, you know, difficult bag mask ventilation is an indicator that things might not be going according to plan and that you may need to deviate from your original plan. But that's definitely, if you do have a difficult bag mask ventilation, it's definitely not logical to give a long-acting neuromuscular blocking drug after that. Now, that might sound fairly clear and basic. In a study by someone called Broomhead, which was published in the BJA in 2010, a fifth of anaesthetists, if they had difficulty, would have followed it with a long-acting neuromuscular blocker. So I think, yeah, if you are going to check it, at least change your plan. Then there was a couple of articles regarding new intubation equipment and supraglottic airway devices and difficult airway management. And it was quite interesting because I hadn't realized that new airway equipment is hardly ever studied very rigorously. Basically, you have a company that design piece of equipment, it's tested on specially designed mannequins because you don't need any ethics, and then hardly ever do they bother to do real pilot studies or randomized control trials comparing it to the classic LMA, which is your gold standard. Now, the Difficult Airway Society has this team called the ADEPT team. You know how I like Difficult Airway Society. So this is the Airway Device Evaluation Project team. And
they're looking for a professor of the Difficult Airway Society at the moment, Bex, if you're interested.
You might be the front running.
yeah, I'll put my CV in soon. and what they say is that people who are purchasing the airway equipment should actually demand a minimal level of published evidence from the manufacturers. And what they think that level should be is sort of level 3 evidence. Now that's either a case control study if it's 3B or 3A, which is a systematic review of level 3B studies. Now the problem with trying to ever do these types of studies is that in order to reduce user bias, all the participants need to be equally proficient in each device. Now there's a guy called Mulcast, he did a study that showed if you train non-anaesthetists to intubate, they need to intubate about 47 times in order to become proficient at it. So presumably that means you need to try and do the similar thing for each anaesthetist using each piece of airway equipment. And also you're not necessarily comparing like with like. So for example, comparing the glioscope and the Bonfils are two very different pieces of equipment. So whether we ever will get those studies or not, it's hard to say. But I think at the end of the day, you just need to do whatever bit of kit that you're competent and familiar with. Then the last article I read was about the further education in airway management. And I thought there was quite a succinct little summary about NAP4 saying, new report, same old findings.
Tim Cook must have loved that.
To see where we're going. So basically, anaesthetists just don't seem to be able to learn. That's really the problem. And if you look at the cases from NAP4, there was lack of education and training contributing in 50% of cases and poor judgment in 60%. Now, this last article had quite a frank discussion on the fact that just because you have experience, it doesn't mean that you're guaranteed expertise. And actually, that there's different phases of learning. So once you've progressed through the cognitive phase, you then enter this automaticity phase where your performance basically plateaus, and that unless you actively, deliberately challenge yourself, you then have a real danger that you'll remain mediocre for the rest of your career. So the lessons that they've learned from sportsmen and musicians show that if you want to develop expert performance, what you need to do is have deliberate practice sessions. You need to be evaluated and have immediate feedback. And then you need to have the immediate chance to repeat your performance and modify your behavior then. So if you transfer this into anaesthetics, you can see that simulation-based training will be the way forward. But unfortunately, apparently for the best way of learning, it should be distributed at regular intervals over a prolonged period of time. And again, like we are always compared with the Air Force, you should then have periodic assessments and you need to recertify your competencies in the future. So I thought that was quite a dreary way to end the supplement because it just sounds like we're going to be facing a lot more paperwork and documentation for the rest of our careers. However, if it's for patient safety, I'm all for it.
Oh, I can see you interviewing for your consultant post already.
Bet you will not be saying that when you've been a consultant for 10 years and you're dragged up in front of somewhere and you haven't got enough DOPs and KECs and
to say that
everything
you
else
can
and
intubate.
They bust you right back to ST3.
Yeah, we'll see how it
so
goes.
Stop being mediocre.
I just thought that was a terrible thing that you just face being mediocre for the rest of your life without ever getting any better.
Listen, we've all worked with consultants like that. Trainees for that matter.
One thing you did say you were talking about was our or our inability, sorry, to sort of learn from our mistakes or progress with things like airway management, which I've got to say, looking at that, because I've seen that, I've seen people present stuff on the way we do rapid sequence intubations and go back to that very small paper with no control and only 80 subjects and all that kind of stuff, and then how that's exploded into current anaesthetic practice. Now, obviously, we all have been in anaesthesia some time, but in the grand scheme of things, we've all sort of been doing it less than 10 years. But I think there's been a real difference in certainly the time we've been doing anaesthetics between people who have said thiosucks tube, that's how you do every anaesthetic, that's how you do every rapid sequence. But it's gone from that to, you know, acceptable talk of modified rapid sequences to now discussions in anaesthetic literature between experts having serious conversations and lengthy editorials about actually what are we doing. We should be not ventilating, we should be giving these long acting muscle relaxants, HEMS are changing their practice. So I would disagree, and I think we are now actually really progressing as a profession and really thinking about what we're doing and not just going with tradition and challenging these papers on which this stuff's based. So I think the future's slightly brighter than that.
If filled with paperwork.
Yes, absolutely. Swathed in never-ending paperwork. So thank you very much for that, Bex. Presumably you will be applying for the Professor of DAS.
Absolutely.
Very soon. Or you could certainly do some kind of diplomacy for DAS, couldn't you?
Like an official advertiser.
Yeah, well, you've got that nailed. Anyway, Frank, you're going to take us international and highbrow and once again review something from NEJM and looking at a very important and often argued about question.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, and I don't mean to keep on bringing out potentially controversial articles, but as you say, this is from New England Journal and it was published in June of last year now, 2011. And many of you may notice one of the authors, Grit van Berg, who is from the Belgian group, and probably all of us remember the certainly what she's most famous to me for is the glycemic control studies that were run in the intensive care unit there, and obviously that was controversial in its own right and has been for the last number of years, and obviously Nice Sugar did a lot to change our thinking on that. And I mean, I think she's a very impressive researcher, and the study seems to be quite solid. And I think it will once again challenge our thinking on TPN. And what it is a prospective randomized controlled multicenter study with parallel groups. And they were looking essentially at early administration of enteral nutrition, or TPN. And they had a group of 2,312 patients, all of whom received TPN within the first 48 hours of ICU admission. And the second group, which was 2,328 patients, I think, didn't have this initiated before day 8. So the title of the article was Early versus Late Parenteral Nutrition in Critically Ill Adults, and that was obviously the population group they were looking at. And I suppose I should just clarify that these patients did receive some form of enteral nutrition, so where they could and were tolerating it, they would get nasogastric feeds, as most places do now. But and I actually listened to Grit van Berg presenting this, and she was saying there's actually no evidence as to whether or not parenteral nutrition is of any benefit if you look at the academic research. There's also no evidence as to which way of doing it is better, and the early parenteral nutrition is mostly the European take on things, where most, well, and possibly not within the UK, but across Europe, patients tend to be fed early with TPN, whereas the late TPN feeding seems to be more the North American, American and Canadian approach to things. Now, the reason this was, and obviously welcome to have a look at the article online, but the interesting bits were that in the late group, so those who had TPN withheld until day 8, but did receive enteral nutrition as tolerated, and they also, the both groups received micronutrients to make sure that wasn't a factor. But the late group had earlier discharge from ICU, they had a decreased rate in intensive care infections, decreased incidence in cholestasis, about a 10% decrease in the proportion of patients requiring longer-term mechanical ventilation, or certainly a requirement of more than 2 days. They had a median of about 3 days less renal replacement therapy, and obviously all that did mean that they had diminished healthcare costs in that group of patients. Now, that's obviously, you could argue, is quite an unexpected result, given that the whole argument for feeding early is that we think that patients perhaps need the higher caloric intake and that they're in a hypercatabolic state, and enteral nutrition simply doesn't provide sufficient amount of or sufficient caloric intake. And once again, I do seem to have a interest really in the argument for, you know, do we do more harm than good with all our intensive care interventions? And obviously, we've had discussions in the past about that, and you know, whether some of the physiology that we see in intensive care patients may actually be protective and part of the survival effort of the organism, and do we perhaps do more harm than good by doing things like supplementing nutrition. And as part of a presentation, one of the arguments was that this may have to do with autophagy and the fact that one of the ways that damaged cells are metabolized and got rid of are by the body's ability to produce autophagocytes that break these down and get rid of toxins and waste products. And I mean, this is obviously an area of interest, but of research, is that they've found that starting feeding in critically ill mice actually switches autophagy off, so it does away with that process, and perhaps that actually hampers the healing process and recovery. Anyway, so it's some food for thought, excuse the pun. But it'll be interesting to see if that does alter our approach to feeding in intensive care patients.
Yeah.
Nice. I want to know what happened to the critically ill mice.
There's a lot of mice suffering in academic anesthesia. I mean, the more I get, I was quite impressed by, as I said, I went to this intensive care meeting, and prior to that, I'd been to another anesthetic meeting. There's more research, sadly not much of it in the UK, or not enough of it in the UK, but there is quite a lot of interesting research going on in anesthesia. But sadly, most of the time, it's mice that suffer.
I thought that was a really interesting paper, partly because it's not something that I've ever thought about. I've always gone along with the argument of feeding must be good. Never occurred to me that, in fact, feeding is actually pretty bad. And I've had quite a few very heavy patients recently in ITU, and the dietitian's always coming up and writing up their caloric requirements, which are incredible, you know, thousands and thousands, like 5,000 kilocalories a day and this sort of thing. And then insisting we get TPN straight into them if we don't think they're going to be tolerate enteral nutrition. And I just kind of go along with it. I just, on the it can't be doing any harm route. But then all this sort of autophagia hypothesis and the fact that they've got all this inflammation going on already and they need to be able to clear it and they're not clearing it, really interesting. I know I read a couple of the letters to the editor about this, and a couple of things that stuck out for me were that half the patients were discharged on day four and so wouldn't have had time or something to get into the later feeding group. There was no blinding. They didn't work out a way of blinding the patients, obviously, but also the patients' relatives or the people looking after them, although apparently people who are looking after them subsequently were blinded. But that seems a bit messy to me. And then I think 60% of the recruited patients were cardiac patients who weren't anticipated to have any sort of enteral feeding problems anyway. Is that right?
No, I think you're quite right with all of those. But again, you know, I mean, I think it's a kind of study that is difficult to run. I think they, you know, looking through the study and having heard the presentation, I think they did a reasonably good job of doing it well within the parameters they had to.
I think it's a bit like the FEAST trial. It's some really, really interesting and very surprising results. You can't make any kind of dictums with regards to any one group of patients out of it. But certainly it makes you stop and think, actually, is what we're doing and what we've been doing for some time now, is that in fact the correct thing to do, or are we, as you said, and we've talked about many times before, doing more harm than good with some of our intensive care interventions?
And I think if nothing else, it is a signal to just, you know, have a closer look at this aspect of intensive care and see whether we do need to rethink it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's worse. It's amazing that you could actually be doing harm as opposed to just having no effect. I think no effect would be better, but to be actually doing harm is quite concerning, isn't it? That you think you're supposed to be helping and you're actually being a complete hindrance.
Well, we're going to have to change, get the Hippocratic Oath changed to first do no harm unless you've seen a randomised control trial that your intervention does in fact not cause harm in this specific patient group.
Yeah.
It's going to make doing medicine a very, very complicated and even more tedious job.
Well, moving away from tedium and onto our new Ask the Audience feature, Question of the Month. Mark is going to be in charge of this new section where every month he is going to set an anaesthesia-related question which we're hoping enthusiastic listeners will try to solve and then get in touch via the website or Twitter to give us the answer. We'll announce the first right answer in the next podcast and award you the maddest of mad props.
That's right. In fact, I'm gonna go as far as to say I will give more than mad props. I will personally award a prize to anyone who can be bothered to answer this question.
Cash prize.
No, I've got wind of a very good new physics and anesthesia book due to be released soon, and I will personally buy a copy of that book. Bearing in mind that my answer is final, and yeah, deal with it. Okay, so the question for this month is, if you were to take all of the endotracheal tubes used in the UK in a year and line them up end to end, starting on the doorstep of the Royal College of Anaesthetists in a due east direction, where would the other end of the line of ET tubes be?
That is such a nerd question. I think you've outdone yourself. You don't want to peek too soon in this.
Yeah, it's a good one. I'm going to allow a couple of assumptions to be made to give anybody any chance of coming up with the same answer I have. And let's assume that all of those tubes are uncut size 8 tubes.
Okay, so ideally they need to send in their working as well.
Yeah, and if anyone gets anywhere close, like I say, my decision is fine.
And presumably you know the answer because you've actually done this experiment.
Yeah, I've modelled it. I haven't done the experiment. I've mathematically modelled the experiment, yes.
Good. All right, well, I look forward to receiving those answers and then finding out the answer to this question of devastating importance, Wiz.
I have a feeling no one's going to win a book.
Oh, really? Because that would have been one sold. So, moving on to my news item, which carries the slightly daunting title of a genome-wide association study using pooled DNA to identify candidate markers mediating susceptibility to postoperative nausea and vomiting.
Right.
I chose to tackle this paper for two main reasons. Firstly, it's from Anesthesiology, which for anyone who doesn't know, is one of the two big American journals and is pretty much free. I'm unsure as to how their business model works, but every new issue, much of the content is free through their website, as soon as an issue reaches 5 months old, the whole thing becomes free. As I said, I'm unsure how it works, but I'm often coming up against paywalls, and my institutional login doesn't seem to cover very much at all, pretty much just midwifery monthly. So, absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much, Anesthesiology. And
Rick,
my
you'll
second...
be particularly pleased to know that they have a free iPad version as well.
Oh, right. Well, I'm just going to get out my notebook with reasons to buy an iPad on the front, and I'll write that down. And the second this book is full, I'm going to go straight out and go and get one. The other reason I did it is because I've seen quite a few articles and posters related to genome-wide association studies, or GWASs, as they're called, and I've decided that it's something I really need to educate myself on because I don't understand them. I don't really know what's going on. Part of the function of this podcast is that we're not sharing expertise, we're merely regurgitating things that we looked up on Wikipedia. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to continue that tradition. So, rather than start off by describing what they actually did in the study, I think it's probably best just to go through a few bits of the terminology which are important. First one is a SNP, or a single nucleotide polymorphism. What this is a section of DNA where one of the base pairs in a sequence of a gene, so an A, a T, or a C, or a G, is substituted for another one and its associated pair. And this happens at a specific locus or a place on the chromosome. Now, this can occur in coding or non-coding regions, An example of one, which we'll all be familiar with, is sickle cell, which is an A for a T on chromosome 11. That's a single nucleotide polymorphism, which obviously has a demonstrable phenotypic effect. Lots of them are on non-coding regions and actually don't. But the important thing to remember about SNPs is that they're inherited. They may be coding, but most are non-coding. And if you know the location of several SNPs, you can make inferences regarded to closely associated genes. Because when DNA mixes and combines, it does so in specific regions. So if you know that two genes are in between two SNPs, there's one particular gene, you know that when crossover happens in meiosis, whichever bit of meiosis it is, that bit of gene probably goes along with those two SNPs. How many SNPs do we know about? Well, the National Center for Biotechnology Information currently lists 52 million, so quite a lot. So how does this work in a genome-wide association study, and what is it? It's basically a giant fishing exercise. You always do a case control, or you usually do a case control model, where you examine, say, a million known SNPs between individuals who have the condition you're looking at and a group who don't. You're looking at the frequencies of the SNPs between these two groups and then basically doing some stats on them and seeing if there's any statistical significance between your case and your control group, and then having a look at where the SNP is and making inferences from that. You also do something which you'd probably be familiar with if I showed you a picture of it, which is called a Manhattan plot, which is this kind of quite condensed bar chart which seems to sort of explode upwards into the sky. It's quite a pretty thing. And it's basically looking at the various different SNPs, and the higher they go, the more likely they are to be statistically significant, and they draw a line and a cutoff point. The stats for this are huge. You're doing massive numbers of multiple tests and using things which you may have come across before, which are called Bonferroni adjustments, which you use if you do a test over and over again. It's quite similar. If anyone follows the events going on at CERN in the sort of hunt for the Higgs boson, you might have heard something called 5 sigma, which is the significance level of the result they're looking for, which we always use we're familiar with using a p-value of 0.05 or less than a 5% chance of the whatever we're looking at being a random event. With 5 sigma, I think you're looking at significantly lower, you're looking at 1 in 5 million or something. And it's similar with doing these kind of genome-wide association studies. Because you're doing so many analysis of the same SNP, you have to actually get your power down to about 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8, that kind of range, to have a significantly statistical result, because you're doing so many tests like they do with the so many collisions and explosions. The way you actually do the test, and anyone who's actually done any who's listening, I apologize for making this sound horrifically simple, but you use these fantastic things called gene chips, where they just, you get the corresponding anticodon to the SNP that you're looking for, and my Mickey Mouse understanding of it is you kind of chop up all your DNA, give it a wash, stick it in the mixer, stick it on these gene chips, and then have a look at what sticks. And whatever sticks to it must be the complementary bases, and you wash them off, they're radio labeled, and count them up. And that way you know what the various frequencies of them are. Of course, it's massively more complicated than that.
Just a little PhDs on it.
Yeah, just a little bit. But they're called gene chips or microarrays, and they bind the complementary strands. So what's the point of doing all this? In the past, we've used genetic linkage studies, which are very good at rooting out the cause of single gene disorders. However, many things that we come across, we know are multifactorial. And I think these are the sort of disease processes where we would describe them as having a predisposition, or people having a predisposition to them. So hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, these sort of things. What we hypothesize is that these are actually due to a multitude of genes working together in quite a complex fashion. And what we're doing is trying to target and look at what these variations are going to be and trying to predict who will suffer from these things. Although it doesn't really direct you towards any immediate therapeutic applications, and being genetic, often dealing with many, many genes, the predictive power is fairly weak. You could question, you could also question the wisdom of knowing that you have a slightly increased lifetime risk of developing X, Y, and Z. But in the future, it may help with diagnosis, especially as gene mapping becomes exponentially faster and cheaper. SNP analysis in some diseases like hepatitis C has also been shown that response to various treatments can be predicted by genetic variability. So this is opening the way for something which we've probably heard of called tailored therapies. The other unusual thing about this study is that it used a technique which I've not heard before called DNA pooling. So, and again, slightly Mickey Mouse explanation, but my interpretation is that whilst the technology for gene mapping with microarrays is getting cheaper, in the face of dwindling research budgets, people are looking for cheaper ways to cut corners, and DNA pooling is the latest and, if not slightly mucky sounding, attempt to doing that. I think what you do is you get all of your case DNA together, all of your control DNA together, chop it up into equal volumes, and then kind of lump it all into one pot and run it on a single set of arrays. Because much as with one person's sample of DNA, you're looking for one load of SNPs, you're looking for them in your entire case and your control series. So mixing them together should be a shortcut to narrowing down on the number of SNPs you want to individually have a look at. So I think you can then do your genome-wide or your GWAS at a fraction of the cost. So the actual paper, which I had a look at, what we already knew before this was that there's a poorly defined but obviously genetic susceptibility to perioperative nausea and vomiting, or postoperative, sorry. We know that females have more of a propensity towards it. Past history is very important. Motion sickness, correlation with migraines, are all things that seem to play a part. The point of this GWAS was to have a look at this two DNA case control samples and try and see if they could find where the genetic predisposition was. And in fact, they did find something very interesting, that one SNP, which was associated very close to the M3 variant of the muscarinic ACH receptor gene, was found to be statistically significant. To a very high level, which is interesting. And then the rest of the discussion goes on to speculate about the role of this particular receptor with regard to postoperative nausea and vomiting, and why medications such as scopolamine, which are known to act on this receptor, are very useful. So, in summary, I only understood, as you can tell from my discussion of it, about 20% of the paper, but I did really enjoy trying to understand it, and I enjoy trying to keep up with this rapidly emerging field, which as anaesthetist doesn't really bother us on a day-to-day basis. I like the way they publish all of their data online, which I think's really excellent, and they do say that part of what needs to be done now is independent validation of the data that they're presenting. And then everything they do gets submitted to these gene banks. I think it's an area of research where there's lots of good cooperation and corroboration of research findings. They don't try to extrapolate any great therapeutic or clinical insight from their findings, which is good. And I think the point of this paper was more a proof of concept piece with regard to DNA pooling than a proof that through genetic profiling we can... Through genetic profiling, we can find tangible explanations for clinically observed phenomena. I think it's really interesting. I think it's going to be something we're going to hear more and more about in the coming years. And I think as clinicians at the start of our careers, it's important not to try and say, you know, ignore this entire field, which we have no training in, especially as it is cropping up in journals for our specialty. And we really need to try and have some understanding of it. So in a few years' time, when it becomes more prevalent and people can do GWASs on much smaller budgets much more easily, we can kind of understand and be able to interpret more than 20% of the paper than I was able to today.
Complicated stuff.
Is this the bit where we have to decide if that's biology or bunkum?
No, we're not there yet.
No, I think it's it does sound quite a lot like bunkum. I apologise for that, but have a read of the paper and then sit there with Wikipedia on one side and go through it, because that's kind of what I did.
Can I just say that it is? Oh, I was quite amused by your comment in the email. If you think that in fact everyone knows all about this and I'm the idiot, then let me know and save me 10 minutes of insulting people with egg sucking instructions. But I think you're quite safe that people's general knowledge of genome-wide association studies is reasonably low.
It may not be a problem, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's going to be any higher after that. So, really improved the situation. It's probably put people off reading, but there we go. So, from that dismal explanation of cutting-edge research, Mark, I enjoyed having a look at the screenshot of the paper you sent through an hour ago.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna keep this fairly simple and brief. After your quest to explain the universe through research and experimentation, I much prefer to look for evidence that backs up what I already thought to start with. So I have had a look at a new paper from the December issue of Trauma, which talks about pre-hospital intubation, surprisingly enough. And after talking in previous podcasts about how intubation is done, I'm always concerned when I read articles postulate that pre-hospital intubation might actually cause more harm than good, which is a bit similar to what Frank was talking about earlier on. Logically, of course, we know that a lot of the morbidity and mortality coming from traumatic brain injury come from the secondary insult, mainly hypoxia or hypotension. And therefore, it logically follows that if we can mitigate against these things by taking control of an airway, you would think it's going to improve the situation. However, there's lots of ongoing controversy and several papers in the last few years suggesting that there is an association between pre-hospital intubation and increased mortality in patients with traumatic brain injury. And thus the argument rages on. So, in an attempt to address that, these people from Birmingham, Alabama, have put together a single center study looking at people who've had a traumatic brain injury and the intubation patterns between whether they were intubated pre-hospital or in the emergency department or not at all. And the main basis of this article is that they suggest that the reason the evidence has been patchy and controversial so far is that the definitions used to define the patient population have been flawed, in that the majority of previous studies are retrospective, database-driven investigations, usually using a GCS score or an abbreviated injury severity score to define the presence of traumatic brain injury in the patients. These authors propose that actually massively overestimates the amount of people who end up having a proper traumatic brain injury. And so what they've done for this study is they've collected together all patients who were noted to have a GCS score of less than or equal to 8 pre-hospitally, but then they've assessed all of the CT scans using trauma surgeons with experience in CT scans to look at these scans and give them a Marshall score. This is a scoring system described elsewhere, but it goes basically from 1 to 6, with 1 being no visible pathology and 5 being a surgically evacuated or big lesion. Level 6 just says other radiographic findings, so I think that just catches anything that's left over. So what they have found with this is that quite a significant proportion of the people with a GCS of less than 8, where is it, 43.4% turned out to not have a traumatic brain injury according to this Marshall score classification, i.e. this 40-odd% had no visible intracranial pathology, which supports their suggestion that these previous studies have overestimated the population and therefore aren't accurately reflecting whether or not the intubation has helped or hindered the people with a brain injury. The paper goes on to show that, not surprisingly, the people who were intubated pre-hospitally tended to be the sicker ones compared with people who didn't get intubated until they got to the emergency department. But quite interestingly, they show that the pre-hospital care providers seem to be able to seem to be able to differentiate between those patients with a GCS of less than 8 who did have a traumatic brain injury and those who didn't, i.e. they must be taking cues from other things other than just the GCS. And they suggest this might be, you know, things such as the appearance of the scene, or the mechanism of the injury, which you really get to see when you're out in the pre-hospital environment. And the good news is that the people who were intubated pre-hospitally were not doing worse off than the people who are being intubated in the hospital. So according to them, we are not doing harm, and it's a case where for these studies to be valid, we need to be more specific in identifying the exact population we want to study.
So unlike with our TPN or our fluid, we're not doing any harm, but that hasn't said that your job's not a waste of time.
Yeah, it says, well, I think it's even less than not being a waste of time. It's saying that the patients being intubated pre-hospitally were sicker but didn't die anymore. So I think you can infer from that it was a beneficial procedure.
Oh, okay. Good. Cool. Thank you, Mark. So should we wrap up with biology or bunkum, which this month I have themed. For your delight, it's going to be a self-experimentation biology or bunkum. So here are your three stories. In 1724, William Stark, a physician from London, discovered the link between vitamin C and scurvy by putting himself on a series of 24 incredibly restrictive diets over 8 months, deliberately giving himself scurvy, then adding and subtracting food groups until he worked out the links between the curative items. Number two, in 1983 in Las Vegas, at the meeting of the Eurodynamic Society, Professor G.S. Brindley stunned audiences during the delivery of his lecture on vasoactive therapy for erectile dysfunction by first showing them a series of slides of his own erect penis, which he then followed up by hoiking up his trouser bottoms around the contours of his tumescent member to demonstrate the results of an intracorporeal papaverine injection that he performed on himself shortly before the lecture. Or number three, disulfiram, or as you probably know it better, antabuse, was originally developed as a treatment for parasitic infections. However, three of the researchers working for the company were taking part in a bit of self-experimentation and reported severe symptoms while taking the experimental medicine and alcohol concurrently, and so antabuse was born. So those are your three stories. We haven't started for a while with Rebecca.
I reckon the only one that's true is the antabuse.
Sadly, that's not because how I the think... game works.
She still doesn't know the rules, and so seventh podcast.
Yeah, disqualified. My turn.
I don't think there can be one that's nonsense. I think there are two that are nonsense.
Well, there is only one, and you have to pick it.
All right. I actually think that there are enough freaks out there that some guy would have shown his bits in public. So probably, it's hard to say. I don't know. Do I have to make a guess?
Again, yes.
Okay, I reckon A is bunkum then.
A is bunkum. Okay. Yeah. Mark, you're keen to have a
crack. Yeah, I know this one. I'm so generally well read that
should we go to Frank then?
I've heard the first two stories before, and so I think they're true, and therefore I think the antabuse one is bunkum.
Interesting.
I was going to go for the first story being bunkum and the other two being true. I think it's fantastic that urologists would do that, and I think it's weird enough for it to be true. And I thought antabuse was discovered as a serendipitous side, or not very pleasant serendipitous side effect. But then again, there might be enough truth woven into that lie, Rick, as is your usual.
Well, let's go through them then, in an interesting turnaround for this month's Biology of Bunkum. Let's start with the Las Vegas story. What stays in Vegas apparently goes in the British Journal of Urology. This is in fact true.
This paper, I heard about it. So I've actually read it.
Yeah, wait, this is 1983.
It was 1983, but it was recently brought up in an editorial in the British Journal of Urology, which I don't know how I came across it. I think it was on Twitter or something. But
maybe I told you.
Maybe you did. But I'll link to the editorial, and it's absolutely fantastic. This guy was actually a psychiatrist, but he was talking at the Urodynamic Society meeting. And this guy
specifically went in with some loose-fitting jogging bottoms so that he could pull this off.
Yeah, so he could pull it up and show everyone through the contours of his jogging bottoms. Everyone thought it was a bit weird. Why is he not wearing a suit? But yeah, it's a really nice editorial, actually, because it's a guy who is actually in the lecture theatre. And, you know, he says it was unbelievable and people were going out screaming. I think later on he describes that he wasn't happy with people just looking at the contours and was walking around showing people his tumescent member. Which is fantastic. But actually this guy made some quite profound discoveries to do with erectile dysfunction, and many of the earlier treatments I think are based on stuff that he did. So good for him, Professor Brindley. And not a shy man. And his penis is actually described in quite some detail as well in this editorial. So that was true. So in a total turnaround, Mark, who's usually ahead of the game with this, Mark, the Antabuse story is totally true. It was a Danish company who were looking at it as an agent against parasitic infections.
Parasites.
Yeah, and they were, I don't know why they were taking it, but they went out and got drunk and were severely unwell. The way Antabuse works actually blocks the transformation of acetaldehyde in the liver into its breakdown products, and that's the thing that gives you a hangover. So basically you get a massive accumulation of acetaldehyde and an almost instant hangover, which is why it's so unpleasant whenever you drink with Antabuse. But it does also have action against Giardia. So that brings us to William Stark, who is the London physician. Now, there is definitely some truth here, but this guy was not a very...
Well, now, you don't know how the game works.
No. This is how it works. There's some truth, but there's obviously an obvious lie. And the obvious lie is that he did not discover the link between vitamin C and scurvy, because that didn't come about until 1930, because we couldn't get down to the actual molecule of vitamin C. And this guy was not a very good self-experimenter. He was an English physician who actually studied at St. George's, which is where Mark and I went, who decided to investigate scurvy on himself with fatal consequences. He did these 24 restrictive diets, such as things like bread and water, for 31 days, and then he'd gradually add other things in. But anyway, after 8 months of it, just before he got onto the fruit and veg section of his experiment, he died from scurvy. He'd only got as far as honey puddings and Cheshire cheese, apparently. And yeah, then he carked it.
I have heard that. I remember I heard that on a documentary that, now that you mention it.
Yeah, but I'm afraid he made no discovery. He just basically gave himself scurvy and died.
Poor man.
Well, that wraps it up for this month's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. @gascast is our handle. And we'll be back in February.